We've just heard excerpts from three Centropa interviews, first-hand stories of those who managed to get away from the German army and the Waffen-SS on June 22, 1941. The vast majority of Jews in this region did not. Well over 15 million, maybe as many as 25 million people, were taken out of harm's way when the Germans invaded the Soviet Union. Entire factories were transported, and then the Soviet Union had to feed and clothe all those who worked in them and their families as best it could. While there have been numerous books published on Operation Barbarossa, there is a deficit that's now been filled by two specialists. Wendy Goldman, the Paul Mellon Distinguished Professor of History at Carnegie Mellon University, and Donald Filzer, Emeritus Professor of Russian History at the University of East London. Their book, Fortress Dark and Stern, The Soviet Homefront During World War II, takes us through personal stories as well as through their research that they conducted into a story that not many of us know. We have with us Wendy Goldman of Carnegie Mellon, so let me begin, Wendy, by asking you this. What was the response of the Soviet government to the invasion in June of 1941? And could you tell us a little bit about what the response was of Soviet citizens?
Stalin knew that invasion was imminent. He had been receiving increasingly detailed intelligence from Richard Sorge, a German journalist and Soviet intelligence officer who was based in Japan. Yet Stalin was desperate to stall for time. The country was still short of operable armaments, tanks, and ammunition. Now, it's important to understand that Operation Barbarossa, the three-pronged attack by the Germans on June 22, 1941, was the mightiest military force ever concentrated in a single theater of war. The vast majority of German divisions were concentrated on the Eastern Front. Initially, events on the military front were disastrous. The Red Army fell back. It fought hard in many sectors, but like all the armies of Europe, it faltered before the power of the Blitzkrieg. What's significant and even less well-known, however, is that the government moved very quickly and effectively on the home front to put in place policies that ultimately allowed the country to win. It set up a Soviet for evacuation 2 days after the invasion, a committee to account for and redistribute the labor force within 1 week, a rationing system within 3 weeks, and public health controls to cope with the epidemics soon raging along the railroad routes. These basic systems became the pillars of wartime home front policy. The territory conquered by the Germans contained 40% of the Soviet Union's pre-war population and about one-third of its industrial output. This territory was the center of mining, metallurgy, machine production, electrical power, and defense. It was also the breadbasket of the country, a rich area of wheat fields, sugar beets, and food processing factories. The Soviet government made the decision to evacuate people, grain, and industry from west to east, outside the range of German bombers. It was a feat unprecedented in any country in the history of warfare or disaster. And most importantly, it allowed the Soviet Union to maintain defense production to supply the Red Army. About 37% of the pre-war value of the occupied territory's industry was rescued. In fact, I think we can say that it was the feet that won the war. Soviet citizens had a range of reactions to the invasion. In the frontline zones, the Germans moved so fast that the government in Moscow lost touch with frontline commanders and local Soviet officials. In fact, military commanders often lost touch with their own troops. It was very hard for anyone, from Stalin to local citizens in the path of the German advance, to get up-to-date information about where the front was even located. Many people in the frontline zones panicked. Some fled, others stayed, and soon fell under German occupation. In other areas, more toward the rear, where there was a bit more time, the Soviet for evacuation was able to rescue children and other vulnerable populations. Workers labored round the clock to pack up the great metallurgy factories in Dnipropetrovsk and other cities and load the machinery onto boxcars headed east. They often worked up to the day before the German army took the city. They worked under bombing and amid fires and even floods. Workers had to constantly improvise to load heavy machinery weighing 50 tons or more onto railway cars. Between August and October of 1941, 80% of Soviet war industry was, quote, on wheels. It was packed into boxcars, and it was headed east to safety. In places farther from the front, young and old people volunteered en masse for the war effort. Young people, including young girls, besieged the recruiting stations to enroll in the Red Army. Many older, retired workers showed up at the factories, asking to be reemployed and stepping into the jobs of workers who left for the front. Large numbers of city dwellers enrolled in the People's Militia, or Opolchenia, and some even fought alongside Red Army units in defense of their cities. Many retirees became fire spotters on rooftops, watching the skies and helping to put out incendiary bombs that fell during the nighttime bombing raids.
I would like to know, if it's possible to know, how many Jews the Soviets rescued, if that's the right word for it, by evacuating them to Central Asia and Siberia.
The historian Yitzhak Arad calculates that the Soviet evacuation authorities rescued about 1.63 million Jews who otherwise would have been murdered. They were given a safe haven in the East. The Soviet government considered Jews a nationality, like Georgians, Armenians, or Ukrainians. And when the Soviet for evacuation went into action, it did rescue people by category, but nationality was not one of its categories. One of the first categories targeted for evacuation, for example, was children, regardless of their nationality. Workplace affiliation constituted another category. People were evacuated with their workplaces, and they were encouraged to take their families with them. Factories received orders to leave along with their workers, as did universities, medical, scientific, government, and cultural institutions. All employees were provided tickets for themselves and their families for specific trains, leaving the stations in their area at specific times. Coordination here was essential. The railroad lines were tremendously overloaded, with soldiers and equipment being rushed to the front, and coal, food, and other essentials being sent to the rear. Evacuated people and supplies added to the vastly increased traffic of war. And there was a terrible shortage of boxcars for everything. The Jews that were rescued left with their fellow workers or colleagues and their families. Jews and non-Jews were rescued together. No one fully understood at the time, in the pandemonium of that horrific summer and fall of 1941, that the Germans intended to slaughter the entire Jewish population, the sick, the old, women, men, and children who remained in the occupied territories.
Well, some Jews understood that they had to run as fast and as far as possible in June of 1941. More than a few, especially older Jews, refused to evacuate. Why was that?
There are many reasons Jews decided to stay. First, many Jews had the experience of living under German occupation during World War I. They remembered this occupation as being relatively benign for the civilian population, and many thought of the Germans as, quote, cultured people. Second, people did not understand the magnitude of the threat. Jewish refugees did arrive in some places with horrific, terrible tales of mass killings, but these were thought to be isolated incidents. Sometimes the people who arrived were so upset and traumatized that others thought they had to be exaggerating, or perhaps even crazy. So people discounted what they did hear. Third, many Jews lived in small towns and villages, far from any rail station. Even if they had wanted to leave, they had no way to get to a train. Ponomarenko, the secretary of the Belarusian Communist Party, called Stalin the day after the invasion to request permission to evacuate Belarusia. Ponomarenko told Stalin that Western Belarusia was already lost, but they had to move immediately to evacuate Minsk and the eastern provinces. So for many Jews in the western regions, the Blitzkrieg moved so fast that they never had the opportunity to leave. Fourth, in many places, the Soviet for evacuation in Moscow lost touch with the frontline zones as the Red Army fell back or was encircled. People could not get good information about what was happening on the front. And finally, it was not always possible for the elderly, the sick, mothers with small children, or pregnant women to leave. Many stayed behind to care for weaker family members. People were unsure whether vulnerable family members could survive a long and difficult journey. And by the time they understood that the Germans planned to exterminate them, they were lined up, naked, with their children in their arms, at the edge of vast pits. And by that time, it was too late.
In two of the stories we just heard, they told us how awful conditions were when they reached Central Asia. Grandparents died of hunger and disease. Our interviewees told us that they survived on near-starvation diets. In Fortress Dark and Stern, you and Donald Filzer tell us just how difficult it was for the millions who had found refuge in the East. Aside from the difficulties everyone was having, were things any worse for Jews in Central Asia? Was anti-Semitism much of a factor then?
The food situation for everyone in the Soviet Union was horrific. The territory occupied by the Germans contained almost 40% of the country's pre-war production of grain, and bread was a mainstay of the Russian diet. The government set up a rationing system within 3 weeks of the invasion. There was no commercial sale of food during the war in state stores. There was food available in peasant markets at free market prices, but these prices were exorbitant and often beyond the reach of ordinary people. On the other hand, state rations, which provided the bulk of people's calories during the war, were not sufficient to meet their biological requirements. And even defense workers, the highest provisioned category, began to starve by 1942. So the food situation was very, very bad. Evacuees and refugees sold clothing and other items en route and upon arrival to survive. Although the state provided rations to evacuees for their journeys, the train trips often took far longer than planned. These journeys, often in boxcars, without seats or toilets, were very hard on people, and they lasted for weeks and sometimes even for months. People fell sick en route, and vast epidemics of typhoid, typhus, and measles swept the evacuation routes. Many Jewish refugees and evacuees did experience anti-Semitism. Evacuation exacerbated ethnic hostility among many different peoples. Thousands of hungry, ragged people, Jews and non-Jews, arrived in towns with little infrastructure. They needed to be fed and housed. Local people were forced to take families into their apartments or into their village huts. And often these people came from very different backgrounds. They competed for food, created long lines in the stores, and drove up prices in the markets. In general, people under stress often resort to stereotypes and ethnic hostility to explain their resentments. Let me read an excerpt from a Centropa interview that we used in Fortress Dark and Stern. Here's Semyon Falk reflecting on his experience. The local residents in Pokrovka were very sympathetic with us. They tried to help with whatever they could. However, there was a constant flow of people coming into evacuation. The population of Pokrovka became 40 times bigger than it originally was. Life was getting very hard. There wasn't enough food, so it became expensive. Some people had money or valuables with them, which they could sell to buy food at the market. The local population was poor. Gradually, their warmth towards those in evacuation faded, and they developed open hatred towards us. They blamed those that had come to the village for the change in their situation. Besides, anti-Semitism was demonstrated by other nationalities that were in evacuation, and local residents learned promptly that Jews were to blame for everything negative. I heard the word Jid, or kike, for the first time there in Pokrovka.
All of us at Centropa love it when academics use our archive for their research, and with over 350 interviews from the Baltics, Russia, Ukraine, and Moldova, you must have had a field day with some of these personal stories. Was there one of our interviews that has stayed with you?
There are many interviews and stories that moved me deeply and stayed with me. I would urge all of our listeners to make their own foray into the Centropa archive. Just type in centropa.org and you can begin your own journey into the past. I'll warn you, though, once you enter this world, it's difficult to extricate yourself. But because we've been dealing today with the invasion and the theme of evacuation, the feat that saved millions of people from Nazi brutality and extermination, and the feat that enabled the Soviet Union to supply the Red Army and to push the Nazis back to Berlin, I want to read an excerpt from the testimony of Frieda Waldman, who was 13 years old when she and her mother were evacuated from Kiev to Central Asia. They put us on a train going to Central Asia. It was a long trip. We hardly had any clothes that could be bartered for food. Sonia, the wife of my mother's brother Yosef, was with us. She had a baby girl named Fiera. Sonia didn't have any milk. We were starving. At one point, when the train stopped, my brother ran to the fields to get some snow and melted it on our little stove. We gave this drink to the baby, but Fierichka, the baby, died. Sonia held her, afraid that somebody would take her baby away. Our neighbor, who was traveling with us, asked, "Why is Fiera so silent? Why isn't she crying?" And Sonia said, "I don't know. She may be asleep." The neighbor looked at the baby. Dear Lord, she was dead. And she began to cry, saying that Fiera had died. Soldiers came immediately and said they had to take the dead baby to a special car of the train. Many people were dying on the train, and their bodies were taken to a special car. It took my brother some effort to take the dead girl from Sonia. He took her to that car. At one point, the train stopped, and all the dead people were buried in a common grave. And our Fierichka stayed there too, in a common grave somewhere. We don't even know where it is.
Once again, I'd like to thank Wendy Goldman for taking the time to speak with us. And we really do recommend the book that she has written with Donald Filzer, Fortress, Dark and Stern.